Hello. How are you? Glad you're here.
Ooh, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're here.
I'm very glad we're here. Skin
it's a
of
bit
our
of a
teeth.
Race. We made it.
One of those days.
Yes, indeed.
But it is Friday, 5 p.m., the happiest of all happy hours.
That's right.
On Friday.
Yay.
And Heidi and I are here once again to bring you another edition of American Hit Radio.
Where
the
are
Friday
we?
Edition, actually. Yeah, I know. I get a little confused when we have, you know, of course, when we have this extra show, when we ever since we've been doing Wednesdays and Fridays, it was originally Tuesdays and Fridays, but since we got the second day, we've always been doing two completely different shows for each day rather than, you know, we've altered the theme for the second day.
Right.
To keep it interesting. And I didn't want to come on. You know, this is a great station. And when I first had the opportunity, when they offered us the second date, the easy thing would have been to just rebroadcast what we were doing on the other day. But I mean, this is a great spot to have to be on the radio, 5 o'clock
sure.
on a weekday. And the station
deserves.
We got
to show some appreciation.
Absolutely. And the station, right, it deserves to have good, fresh, vital radio, which means they better get somebody else to do this.
Oh, don't say that.
And I'm getting old. I'm anything but fresh and vital. Actually, I'm very happy to be here, and I'm really glad that you're here as well. I hope that you do enjoy what we do on Wednesdays and on Fridays. Fridays, we change things up by calling the show How Music Changed. And what we've been doing for about the past few years now is looking at various topics that from a master list that we had compiled of what we considered to be 250 of the most important artists and or events of recorded music history. And just looking at them, you know, one at a time. Some of them only take one show. The earlier ones went very quickly. Others, like the Beatles, this is actually part 66.
Amazing.
Today. Part 66 dedicated to the Beatles. Now, I think we actually did more shows for Motown. I'm not positive, but I think with Motown, I think we might have hit.
But that's not one band.
Right. It was for Motown, what we had done is we had covered every single A-side that was ever released by the label.
That's
every
pretty incredible,
single,
too.
Which was a pretty amazing thing.
Come on.
And we did that up until the year 1972, which was, you know, their vital period. And what we've done with the Beatles is we're trying to look at every single thing that was officially released by the band, which has proven to be a rather gargantuan task. There was much more than I had originally expected when we started.
It's no small undertaking.
And compiling this as we went, yeah, it takes a lot of homework to do these shows, I got to tell you. You really don't want to miss something and find out later on, like, oh, man, I totally
forgot
to play
this. Well, there's so many people who are experts out there on this stuff. You know,
exactly.
They know it inside and out. So
no,
if
much
you
more
mess
than
up,
I do.
You get a lot of phone calls.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. So it's been on me to be as accurate as possible. And through 60, this will now be the 66th hour dedicated to the Beatles. That's
wow.
That's a lot. It's essentially going to be like, you know, three full 24-hour days probably by the time we're done. Maybe a little less. Because this show catches us in the middle of July, starts at least in, you know, July of 1969, when it's all essentially over for the band anyway. We've got one album to go, and then we just sum it up. It's a matter of how they break up and, you know, as they go off
all
their
the
separate ways.
Stuff.
The sad stuff, right? The postscript, so to speak. But I think we're going to be able to wrap up the music with, you know, today's show, two more shows dedicated to the album Abbey Road, and then the postscript shows, and then that's it. We move on. So, How Music Changed will still be here, just on different topics. And believe me, there's plenty
right.
more to do. I think so far we've maybe done 25 or 26 out of the 250. So we're barely 10% done with that list. I will need to live to be 148 years old to finish this.
Give it your best shot.
I'm working on that too. I really am. Well, anyway, let's get right into it then.
Too late.
Too late for that. But anyway, let's try to get into it then, at least.
There you go.
If not right into it. As I said, in the summer of 69, things were so fractured that it's really a miracle that the Beatles could even achieve anything. Individually, they all more or less felt it was over. The only Beatle that was in real denial about that was Paul at this point in time, still really believing that they still might be able to hold it together one way or another. But everybody else just, they all had their moments. George was absolutely ready to go. John really didn't seem even remotely interested in what the band was doing at all. Yet somehow, in the midst of all this unbelievable mess, coming off of the debacle of what was the Get Back sessions and everything else, they still managed to get together to compile one of the most seamless albums of their entire career. It seems almost a miracle that that could have happened, but upon analysis, it's fairly simple to figure out how that happened. The main reason is that the band decided to stop playing games with some of their ideas about independence, but recording for themselves, about trying to do things live, about recording in their own basement, about pulling away from the people who were helping give them a sense of control, and of returning to the one person in particular who did more to help the Beatles realize their visions than any other human being throughout the course of their career. And that was producer George Martin. They were smart enough to say that maybe he could help get them back on track. And the day that this really began to come to fruition, to move in this direction, was July 1st, 1969. I'm going to read this straight from the book Chronicle from that date. The sessions that began a new, if short-lived, recording era for the Beatles, back to EMI Abbey Road, back as something resembling a cohesive unit, and back under the supervision of producer George Martin. Post-Get Back material had been taped irregularly and with no specific project in mind. All sessions now had an end objective, a new album, though it didn't yet have the title. It would be called Abbey Road. 22 days of this month saw the Beatles' studio action and the group block booked. The 2:30 until 10 p.m. slot in the studio, every weekday from July 1st until August 29th. They intended to work. Paul was the only Beatle in the studio on this particular day, overdubbing a lead vocal onto the Olympic recording of You Never Give Me Your Money. John couldn't have attended even had he wanted to. Along with Yoko, his son Julian, and her daughter Kyoko, he was involved in a motor accident while on holiday in Scotland and was hospitalized there until July 6th. So although things start off a bit fractured, the idea is to get back literally to where they once belonged, get back into Abbey Road Studios with George Martin and the and the staff, you know, for EMI. Second date, Wednesday, July 2nd. This was one of those 3 to 9:30 p.m. sessions. Living so close to Abbey Road, Paul invariably arrived first at EMI, and so was often the first to start work. On this day, before the arrival of George and Ringo, John was still in the hospital, Paul used the solo studio time to record another of his spontaneous link tracks, the 23-second Her Majesty, singing live to his own acoustic guitar accompaniment and completing it in three takes. It promptly joined the list of songs for medley consideration. At this point, apparently, it was already discussed among the Beatles that coming out of Get Back, they realized that they had a real hodgepodge of half-baked songs, things that really were unfinished, and that maybe what they could do to utilize some of those pieces of songs would be to string them together into one long medley. Although they had no real idea how to do this, they just kept coming up with different bits of pieces that were lying around and worry about how they were going to string them together later. At this point in time, Her Majesty, the song that ends Abbey Road after about a 30 seconds of silence, was considered to be placed smack dab in the middle of that medley somewhere. It was a style of writing that Paul had been doing for some time. Right. Even on You Never Give Me Your Money, you hear that what that is it's Paul compiling a bunch of different song ideas and stringing them together so that they end up sounding cohesive. So really, all of side two of Abbey Road ends up sounding like the whole thing is in a sense, part of the long medley. But at this point in time, none of that is even happening. They're just trying to compile their ideas. Let's cut forward a little bit then to July 9th. Wednesday. This is John's first session after recuperating from his car crash. And the session was for Paul's Maxwell Silver Hammer, the song almost recorded back in October of 1968 as a last-minute addition to the Beatles' The White Album, and then rehearsed but not recorded at Twickenham Film Studios, in January during the shooting of Get Back and Let It Be, whatever you want to call it. As inseparable as ever, Yoko returned to EMI Studios with John, although, because she was injured more seriously than he was, and because she was pregnant, she rested in a double bed especially brought into Abbey Road.
Oh, my goodness.
Causing considerable sniggering and whispering around the building. You could imagine. On that day, then, July 9th, 1969, was Paul trying to get this song done. There was also a lot of sniggering and whispering among the band about this song in particular. There was annoyance that Paul would spend so much time on a song like Maxwell's Silver Hammer, because he apparently took 3 days to see it to fruition, and the band thought that he was being like selfish and really domineering with one of his songs when there was so much other material to be
covered.
To be covered. But Paul's attitude was, look, I just want to get it right. And it was typical, you know, Paul being the Beatle who craved perfection and the other Beatles who were just kind of tired of the whole situation. Here then, though, written the notes from Anthology 3, where the track is listed, just pretty much says, this was recorded for Abbey Road, the Beatles spending this day working on the basic track. To preserve the feel, Paul sang with every take, planning to re-record the vocal when the best instrumental recording was decided upon. That turned out to be track 21. Presented here is the previously unreleased take 5, lacking the many overdubbed elements, the anvil, for one, that would feature in the master. Here is that version of Maxwell Silver Hammer.
One more. It was good, you know, it had nice bits in it. But it would be nice to have the nice bits and the other bits.
I agree. I agree with that.
He wants it all.
That's, yeah, well, he was a Beatle. Paul obviously working toward perfection on the track Maxwell's Silver Hammer. It was Paul who was beginning to get very obsessed with the idea of having this album be one of the most well-produced albums released by the Beatles, which it you could argue that it was perhaps one of the most well-produced albums. It was the first album to feature any synthesized instruments.
Huh.
Well, I should say, you know, basically it's where they were bringing in the Moog synthesizer.
Okay.
And using it very sparingly, thank goodness. But in the little bits that are on there, they're very interesting. To this date, they don't sound dated, which is pretty amazing because most of the bands that were using the Moog at this point in time were using it in silly ways. Here you can hear the demos. They're not really playing with that sort of instrumentation at all. It still is just, you know, the simple instruments of bass, drums, piano, etc.
Right.
Bit of guitar. Now, while this is going on, you know, pointing to John's indifference, you really need to know nothing more than reading this excerpt, again from Chronicle, from dating July 21. John had maintained a low profile during recent sessions and hadn't offered the group a new song since The Ballad of John and Yoko back on April 14th. Not a single song at all.
Hmm.
So John's head is elsewhere. But on this day, he corrected matters. Working in Studio 3 all day and Studio 2 in the evening, he recorded 8 memorable basic track takes of Come Together onto 4-track, with John basically handling the lead vocal on hand claps. That's all that he was doing. George played lead guitar, Paul on bass, Ringo on drums, of course, and then copying this into an 8-track take 9 for later overdubbing. This day also saw the full-time return of Jeff Emerick to the Beatles recording console. If you recall, he quit earlier on.
He couldn't take it anymore.
To all the squabbling that was going on. He was now the chief balance engineer at Apple Studios, so he returned to EMI as the first freelancer to work aboard at Abbey Road, while his erstwhile friendly colleagues accorded him a frosty reception. Like an old friend who basically, they felt like he might have turned
his
backs on them. I can hardly blame Jeff at all, though, when you read about some of the things that were going on. It's like, enough is enough. Well, interestingly, Anthology, once again, they took a track from this date, July 21, and they actually have Take One. Every time they did a take, John committed another vocal to every take, working on it as it went along, figuring that it might improve. You know, obviously a great way to work. Here is that very early Take One, though, of his track Come Together.
One, two, three, four.
You know me. There's one thing.
over me.
Talk about coming in with a fully formed idea. I mean, if that's take one.
That's pretty amazing.
It's there. Everything is there. Every single piece is there already. Amazing. Just really, just the vocal just began to refine itself as John kept singing it.
Yes.
Apparently the song was, before they started recording, it was much faster. And somebody in the band or the band in general just thought that it might be a good idea to try to slow it down, make it a bit funkier. And John immediately liked it the second that he took their advice. And it got that really cool sort of a funky, slinky sound.
It definitely has that.
And it was a new thing for the Beatles. And it gave John something to really sink his teeth into, I think.
Very cool.
Gave his lyrics like a really good bite with what he was trying to go for. Now, of course, we'll talk about this a little bit in future shows, you know, when we talked about Abbey Road. But the lyrics of that song are from a number of things. He started out with a lyric that he basically just a launching pad. He had, you know, "Here Come Old Flat Top" was an old Chuck Berry line from "You Can't Catch Me." And it was just a good way to start a song. And from there, John went into all these really oblique references to various characters and traits about these various characters. It's been pointed out by many that it's John summing up each of the Beatles in very oblique ways. Sometimes complimentary, sometimes not, but still, you know, and it could be seen that way. But if you go too far with that, you end up getting into the whole Paul is dead thing again, you know. Got to be good looking because he's so hard to see, things like that, you know. Like, what's he trying to say there? Anyway, moving forward from there. One other thing that's interesting to say is, like, when that song came out as a 45, that was the A side. Come together, and keep in mind that the first line of the song was a lift from a Chuck Berry song. The song that was put on the B side was George Harrison's love song "Something," and the first line of that song is "Something in the Way She Moves," was a line that George had lifted from his then label mate James Taylor. James Taylor was signed to Apple, and James Taylor had a song on his first solo album on Apple Records called "Something in the Way She Moves." So both sides of that single were each two different Beatles lifting a line from some other songwriter as their inspiration for their own song. Rather an interesting coincidence. Or was it?
Dun, dun, dun.
All right then, July 23rd, reading a little bit about the sessions again. 3 weeks after the recording of Golden Slumbers and Carry That Weight, with its open ending to facilitate the following song in the medley, without knowing what it would be, the next number began on this date. At this point, it had no title other than Ending, but it would become The End.
Oh.
Rather apt title.
Yeah.
Never was a title so apt. Rita should read ahead. Aside from the 23-second Her Majesty, which was tacked right at the end of the LP, almost into the run-out groove, The End was the last song on the last recorded Beatles album. A good deal of rehearsal must have preceded the rolling of tapes during the Studio 3 session, for right from take one, it was a tight recording, picking up with some lead guitar notes and paving the way for Ringo's one and only drum solo on a Beatles song. The group made 7 attempts at the recording, and the style of his solo changed with each of those takes. Rather interestingly. Something that Ringo was not keen to want to do, by the way. He's, like me, drum solos, you know, we don't find them particularly interesting, and I can understand why he would hesitate a bit. But it's smart that he just did it and kept it into, like, below the 30-second mark. The following day, July 24th, I'll read again from Chronicle. If a composer planned on giving a song exclusively to someone else, it was customary for him or her to provide the artist with a demo, usually roughly recorded with either an acoustic guitar or piano. In the case of Lennon and McCartney, Demos tended to be recorded privately with acetate discs usually cut by music publisher Dick James. Paul planned on giving his new song, Come and Get It, to the Apple group The Ivies. So he taped a demo at EMI on this date between 2:30 and 3:30 in the afternoon. 1 hour. Took him no time at all. Fair before enough. The Beatles session. John was in the control room, but Paul did the recording alone, first singing and playing piano, and then overdubbing a double-tracked vocal with maracas, then drums, then bass. The song was mixed into stereo. A copy of the mix was made for Paul to give to the Ivies, and the job was done, all in 1 hour.
Whoa.
Wow. Paul also produced the Ivies' virtual note-for-note copy of his demo. Taped on August 2nd, he encouraged the group to change their name. They became Badfinger. Arranged for Come and Get It to become the main theme tune for Magic Christian, and for Badfinger to snag the soundtrack album, and then watch the song issued as a single climb to number 4 on the British charts.
Very cool.
As you listen to this track, that, first of all, stand amazed in the fact that Paul McCartney literally threw this entire recording together in 1 hour. I know people who work at home and they can do things really quickly, but this all in 1 hour is mind-boggling by any standard. Then, secondly, to be the thing that could amaze you, is listen to how unbelievably similar Paul's demo is to the actual single that was recorded by Badfinger. When Paul produced it, he really tried to make sure that the band captured just about every single essence of this really quickly thrown together demo. So it's, in some ways, it's almost hard to discern the difference. That's how accurately Paul had Badfinger copy it when they released the single version. And it was still a hit in 1 hour. Amazes me. Here's the Paul McCartney version of the tune, Come and Get It. Can you? I mean, every single thing about that track sounds exactly like the Badfinger song, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even right down to the tone of the production.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It stuns me. Do you remember the movie Magic Christian? By the way,
where that song was based on? You talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I loved that movie. That was one of those when I had seen it. It was a midnight movie, and I remember thinking that was one of the more entertaining midnight movies I had ever seen. Peter Sellers and Ringo are just great in it, and it's really funny, and the soundtrack is excellent, and it's a silly movie. It's a very psychedelic movie. It seems like very drug-influenced in a lot of ways, but it was one of those movies that could have only really happened in the 60s with the themes of it. But if you're a Beatles fan and you've seen all the other Beatles movies, Magic Christian comes very close to in feel to being a Beatles movie. Although Ringo is the only Beatle in it, it's just got that sensibility about it. And of course, with Peter Sellers in the lead role, I'd recommend it highly. Although it's a dated film, it's still hugely entertaining.
Fun. It's fun.
And it's a great piece of history of its times. Well, on that same day, July 24th, Paul finished his work. And continuing reading from that day from the Chronicle, the Beatles then recorded a double song contribution to the Abbey Road medley. They put down a bit of Sun King and Mean Mr. Mustard, though the two were not segued together yet. They were taped as one straight recording, although for a few days it masqueraded under the confusing working title Here Comes the Sun King, which is odd because George was already working on a song called Here Comes the Sun. So again, it's like the situation of like the Beatles taking titles from other people. And now it's almost like John's taking a title from George, because the first line of Sun King is Here Comes the Sun King.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't even think about that, because there it is, just one song removed from George's song, Here Comes the Sun, on the album. So it, in a way, it helps to add to the whole sense of this thing being one unified medley, when a lot of it was just wonderful, you know, coincidence and, you know, when things basically fall into place.
Kismet.
Kismet, thank you. Well, the basic track of this double recording was taped in 35 takes. And along the way, every now and then, almost like they were lapsing back to what they were doing during the Get Back sessions, they would every now and then throw in a couple of jams of Gene Vincent's songs. They did a bit of a medley of Ain't She Sweet, a song called Who Slapped John, and Bebop-a-Lula. Any one of them actually probably could have been decent contenders for Get Back had they been recorded back at that time, because the Beatles were actually being a lot more productive now and a little bit more focused, and the musicianship was back. So this is basically a one-off throwaway tune that obviously the Beatles never did consider for release. And it's odd that it happened well after the Get Back sessions. But here it is, just for kicks and giggles. The Beatles doing their version of Ain't She Sweet.
Oh, ain't she sweet? I see you walking down the street. Well, I ask you where, ain't she sweet? Ain't she nice? I look her over once or twice.
John actually obviously not in strong voice at this point in time. Sometimes I'm inclined to want to blame it on some of his drug use that was happening around this time. John was beginning to dabble with some very serious, heavy drugs around this time. But it would probably be unfair to do that because we just heard him sing just a few days ago on the Come Together track, and his voice was incredibly strong and focused. So it wouldn't be right to pin it on any one thing like that. Although I do believe that it probably would have been to some extent a factor, one way or another. Now, since we're talking about, you know, Abbey Road and the medley, although I don't have, you know, that to play right at this point in time, I think it's really interesting to hear how it came together. And the Chronicle gives us some really interesting information about what was happening as they were piecing this together. Now, here we are. We started talking about July 1st, and now here we are at July 30th. The end of that month. This is the excerpt for that date, as it reads. This long day began in Studio 2 with a mixdown of You Never Give Me Your Money, reducing Take 30 into the new best Take 40. This overlapped with action in Studio 3, where, from 2:30 in the afternoon until 10:30 at night, a host of overdubs were recorded. Guitars were put on to Come Together, vocals, percussion, and guitar onto Polythene Pam, and She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. Vocals were placed onto You Never Give Me Your Money, and vocals onto Golden Slumber's Carry That Weight.
Busy, busy.
Really? And there was still no going home.
Whoa.
What a day.
Really?
The time had come to piece together the constituent songs of the proposed medley, to see how they slotted together and which required additional work. Few were yet in a finished state. The End, for example, did not have any vocals yet, but this trial edit was designed to highlight any major faults in the theory of the medley, or the long one slash huge medley, as it was presently called by the Beatles and the production staff. Stereo mixing of all the songs, followed by crossfading and editing, took place in Studio 3 from 10:30 p.m. that night until 2:30 in the morning, making it a real of over 12-hour session for the Beatles this day.
Wow.
So that the
Marathon.
Medley, at this point, here is the form that the medley ran. You Never Give Me Your Money, into Sun King, So Far Good, So Good, into Mean Mr. Mustard, into Her Majesty, into Polythene Pam, She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, then Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, The End. The total duration was 15 minutes and 30 seconds, and all fitted well, except for Her Majesty, which Paul instructed the tape op, John Kurlander, to cut out and throw away.
Oh, my.
Kurlander's EMI training was such that he couldn't bring himself to do that. So after Paul left, he tacked it onto the end of the tape, about 20 seconds after the end. The next day, the medley was cut onto acetate discs at Apple, with Her Majesty still on the end. Hearing it in this way, Paul liked it after all. It was saved from extinction and kept in the same place, which explains why such a long silence precedes it on the finished Abbey Road LP.
Interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Total, absolute happenstance. Told to throw it out and thought better of it. There it is. 2 days later, Friday, August 1st now, new month. One of the most beautiful of all the Beatles recordings of their entire catalog was John's track Because, an exquisite exercise in three-part harmony by the writer plus Paul and George. Recording of the rhythm track took place on this day from 2:30 until 7:30 p.m., comprising an electric Baldwin spinet harpsichord played by George Martin, again, what he brings to this band, electric guitar by John, and bass by Paul. Ringo provided a gentle hi-hat beat, but this was really only for the musician's headphones mix. It wasn't recorded. Take 16 was marked as best, so from 7:30 until 10:30, John, Paul, and George began recording the harmony vocals. The finished recording would feature three sets of these three voices. The first set only was taped on this session. Reading directly again from the notes that come from the book anthology, actually. Well, they actually just give us a little bit of excerpts from this track from this date. So, well, what does it say here? Using the fine acoustics of Abbey Road Studio One, this remix exposes the exquisite harmonies recorded by John, Paul, and George for John's song Because. Clearly, the Beatles enjoyed an innate ability to harmonize, and in their earlier recording days had written two songs, This Boy and Yes It Is, with three-part harmony vocals to the fore. Instrumentation on the mix of this track was very sparse, but here it has been stripped away to reveal the nine voices, vocals recorded once and then overdubbed twice more, in isolation. So then, here is the vocal track of the song Because, recorded on this date.
Because the world is round, it turns me on. Because the world is round,
they sound like they get along. That is just so stunningly beautiful. I mean, there's really very few examples in rock and roll of three non-related singers being able to sound that cohesive together.
That is really unbelievable.
Really, it's a stunningly gorgeous piece of work right there. And especially since John was doing so much at this point in time that was, you know, really like dirty rock and roll, guttural, and he was playing with experiments and really looking like he was trying to look away from things that were beautiful. It's funny that John was the one that often came up with some of the most beautiful bits, just the way that they were working. Let me remind you that you're listening to WHPC 90.3 FM. Our show is called American Hit Radio. Heidi and I are here every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6, doing exactly what we're doing now, looking at some aspect of music history. And having some great deal of fun doing it. As you know, we are right now in the middle of covering the Beatles, well, at the very tail end, I should say, of our coverage of the Beatles, very near the end. Only a couple of shows left to go, really. With this being number 66, if you're familiar with the series, or if there's other shows that you from the past of this bit that you maybe missed or would like to hear again, or maybe there's a specific parts of the band's history that interest you, all of these shows are posted on our website. The previous 65 shows are there and available in their entirety, all 65 of them. If you wish, you could hear the entire series on demand whenever you want to hear them.
Yeah, you could have like a little marathon.
Right, a little Beatles marathon. There's a lot of great music with me interrupting every now and then, and you know, and Heidi interrupting much less than me. If it was Heidi's show, you'd be hearing a lot more music, believe me.
We would have heard it all by now.
Be that as it may, of course, besides the Beatles, we mentioned we've covered Motown, we've covered Marvin Gaye, we've covered James Brown, we've covered the Beach Boys, we've covered early jazz, the birth of the blues, really the birth of recorded music and various things. There's a lot of history on that site, and I would love to encourage you to go there and check it out on our website. Just look for American Hit Radio on any search engine, and our site will come right up. You'll see our Wednesday show on the left side of the homepage. Our Friday show is on the right side. There's one button that says See All Shows. If you click on that, that's exactly what begins to happen. They unfold a page at a time. You might have to dig a little bit because we want to do a little bit of organizing there, but trying to reorganize a website is difficult and hard work, and we'll get to it one day to make it really beautiful and seamless, but they are there. And if you want to hear them, you can choose whichever show you want to hear whenever you want to hear it. So there it is. Like I said, just search on American Hit Radio and it's all there for you. Getting back then to where we left off with the Beatles, we're in August now, and the most next relevant date that I'd like to bring out to everybody's attention is August 5th. Again, I'm relying exclusively on the book Chronicle. I'm not really using any of the Beatles quotes for this show. I'll be saving their quotes for when I actually cover the album Abbey Road, with the Beatles talking about the various tracks, which, by the way, is exactly what we will be doing next week. Next week, we finally do get to the album, Abbey Road. We'll be playing all of side one, along with quotes from the band about the album and some of the circumstances surrounding the making of those songs for that album. Anyway, then, back to Chronicle for August 5th. Home experimentation with tape loops hadn't ended with Revolver. On this day, Paul brought into EMI a plastic bag containing a dozen loose strands of mono tape. Spending the afternoon in Studio 3, transferring the best of these onto 4-track. Sounds like bells, birds, bubbles, and chirping crickets. The effects allowed for a perfect crossfade, affected on August 14th, from You Never Give Me Your Money into Sun King. Solving a problem first brought to light on July 30th. Inside the plastic bag was another tape loop intended for George's Here Comes the Sun, but it was never used. The Beatles were among the first popular musicians to make use of an astonishing new musical instrument, Dr. Robert Moog's synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
George expressed particular interest in the invention and had bought one in America back November 15th, and we even, recorded the album Electronic Sounds, an album full of its strange noises.
It wasn't that great, though.
Which we did play in its entirety a few shows back. Released on May 9th, 1969 on Apple's short-lived experimental label, Zapple. Now, George had his Moog transported into EMI for the Abbey Road sessions. And with Mike Vickers recruited as programmer for a £25 fee, the Beatles began to use it in the closing weeks of the Abbey Road sessions. The instrument, with a huge bank of wires and a large two-tiered keyboard, was set up in room 43 at Abbey Road, and its output was fed from there by cable to any studio the Beatles were working in. Because received the Beatles' first Moog overdubs, played by George from room 43, and taped twice in an evening session at Studio 2, completing the recording. Following this, the Beatles overdubbed their first vocals onto the track, The End. Now, I can read this a little bit from what it actually says. Again, this is the way that the anthology series 1, 2, and 3, it's the last track on the last disc of anthology 3. If you want to know how close to the end we're getting. Here's how the Beatles themselves, how the liner notes of that record puts it. No other group has delivered such an apt farewell as the Beatles. Except for the brief Her Majesty thrown into the Abbey Road master tape almost as an afterthought, the last song on the Beatles' last recorded album was titled The End. Owing to the way the Beatles recorded it, only one of the seven basic tracks, piece has vocals, the master, take 7. The version presented here that we are about to play is a new remix, however, embracing numerous elements that were omitted during the mix sessions for Abbey Road. In particular, there is considerably more guitar, and a further appreciation of the sparring section can be gained from 19 until 55 seconds in, with Paul, George, and John, in that order, take turns to play 2 bars, about 4 seconds, of the guitar solo, passing it around back and forth in a loop, Paul, George, John, Paul, George, John, just like that. The 30-piece orchestral overdub, taped at tremendous cost, considering it lasts less than 20 seconds, also appears a lot more prominently in this new mix. Here it is, then, the alternate mix of the end.
Naturally, extremely reminiscent of the end of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, with the last chord swelling up and then being struck and allowed to fade out slowly. It's almost sad to play that track. I'm going to feel bad when we play it, when we end side two with that, because that it will be the end of what we're covering. Now, we've got time for one more track before we, you know, I'm going to save Abbey Road in its entirety for next week. And I'm going to play this track out of sequence, simply because it's the one track that the Beatles really went back to work on after Abbey Road was released to complete the album Let It Be. But as we know, that was released after Abbey Road, although it was recorded before. But this track actually got some post-production after the Abbey Road sessions. And I'll read this straight from the anthology to see if it helped to clarify that. A quick run-through of George Harrison's I, Me, Mine, which was shot in early January 1969 during the Twickenham rehearsal period of the Get Back project, was set for inclusion in the Let It Be film, and it was in the film, indicating that it also should feature on the accompanying album.
One would think.
But as the song had never been committed to tape with any serious endeavor, the Beatles convened again in Number 2 Studios at EMI some 5 months after completing the final album, Abbey Road. This was actually taking place on January 3rd, 1970, this session for this track, and recorded their last new piece together. The word new is an important qualifier for polishing up previously recorded material for Let It Be continued through to April. But not all of the Beatles participated on this session. John Lennon was on holiday, his absence prompting a rather telling remark, sort of like a mock press statement, from George during the session, which precedes the recording we're about to play. As George, Paul, and Ringo recorded it, I, Me, Mine was short, running to just a minute 34 seconds.
For the Let It Be album, Phil Spector, who was brought in by George and John to reproduce the tapes, extended the length of the song to 2 minutes 25 by means of editing, and he also supervised the overdubbing of orchestral tracks. Although the same master has been used for the anthology, the song appears here at its true length and as the three Beatles recorded it during what turned out to be their very last session together for 24 years.
Wow.
Here then, to end this show, is that rather simple full, without the double editing, edited by Phil Spector, of that track, I Me Mine, and I hope you can join us next week as we finally begin coverage of the album Abbey Road. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
You all will have read that Dave D's no longer with us. But Mickey and Titch and I just like to carry on the good work that's always gone down in number two.
All through the day, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. All through the night, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. Now the frightened are leaving it, everyone's weaving it, coming on strong all the time. All through the day, I'm in mine. I'm in me, mine. I'm in me, mine. I'm in me, mine. I'm in me, mine. All I can hear, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. Those tears, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine.